America's Web Radio, and it's time now for the Infectious Disease Hour. We have Sharon and her guest from a little university up north of Atlanta, Georgia, Vanderbilt. Sharon, are you there and your guest?
Yes, we're here.
All righty.
We're
well,
here.
I'm going to turn it over to you all, and we're going to be talking a little bit about the H1N1, I understand.
Yes, well, I think we'll be talking about quite a few things.
Good.
I'd like to present Dr. William Schaffner. He is the Secretary of the Infectious Diseases Society of America, IDSA. He is currently Chair of the Department of Preventative Medicine and Professor of Medicine of Infectious Diseases at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. He is also a consultant in epidemiology at the Tennessee Department of Health. He was the Chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases at Vanderbilt from 1982 to 1989 and President of the Society of Healthcare Epidemiology of America in 1983. He served on the board of directors of the International Federation of Infection Control and was chair of the ASM Division of Nosocomial Infections. He is currently a liaison member of the CDC Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices and is vice president of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. He is currently a member of the IDSA Immunization Workshop, editor of the Journal of Infectious Diseases, and was a founding member of the Tennessee Infectious Diseases Society. Dr. Schaffner graduated from Cornell University Medical College in 1962, completed both his residency and infectious disease fellowship at Vanderbilt, where he was chief medical resident, and was an epidemic intelligence service officer with the CDC. Welcome, Dr. Schaffner.
Hi, Sharon. It's good to be with you.
Yes. Dr. Schaffner just informed me that he's got some pressing business, so we have about 30 minutes. So let's just get right to it. Where are we with vaccines, Dr. Schaffner? The availability.
You're referring just to H1N1 or vaccines generally?
How about generally, you know, the seasonal?
Oh, yes.
I believe just finished the production run, no?
Yeah. Well, with regular influenza vaccine, the companies have manufactured that vaccine and they're now filling it and shipping it out, so we ought to have an abundant supply of regular influenza vaccine in doctors' offices, clinics, pharmacies, hospitals, and the like by the end of this month and certainly by the beginning of September. And it's terribly important to remember that although we may be a little bit focused on H1N1, we anticipate a regular influenza season. So we could have a double-barrel influenza season, an H1N1 and then a regular, because the two viruses or two kinds of viruses don't really interact. So it's terribly important that everyone get themselves vaccinated with the regular vaccine when it's available.
Will this question's asked all the time, will the seasonal H1N1 provide any sort of protection for the swine H1N1?
Easy to answer, and the answer is no. So you can think of them as quite different. They are sufficiently different such that the seasonal vaccine will provide no protection against H1N1, and if you were one of those approximately million people already in the United States who have had an H1N1 infection, that won't give you any more protection against seasonal influenza. So you've got to go out and get that vaccine regardless.
Very good. So where are we now with the development and the production of the novel H1N1?
Yeah, well, we've had a little bit of new information about that just a few minutes ago. So the companies were able to manufacture H1N1, and they're in the middle of doing that now. The clinical trials regarding that vaccine have just been initiated, and I hasten to add, you know, we create a new influenza vaccine each year, and each year there have to be clinical trials to assess the impact of this vaccine in providing local reactions as well as good antibody responses. So blood draws are necessary from the volunteers. So those studies have just started. I will say just parenthetically, one of the locations is right here at Vanderbilt, and I'm a volunteer, so I got my first inoculation just about a week ago. And I'm due in a couple of days, and they're going to draw that first blood from me as well as other volunteers. So that's all underway. The new news today is that the anticipated arrival time of this vaccine was about mid-October. And it was anticipated that it would arrive with a bang, that is, about 120 or thereabouts million doses were going to be available. That would have really given us a great start on our vaccination program. But just today, we've learned that many fewer doses will be available. And so it looks that like instead of 120, only about 45 million doses will be initially available, and then we'll get more with each week. But that means that as we initiate our H1N1 vaccination campaign, assuming we're going to do that, that the initiation will be much more modest and will have to be much more targeted to a smaller group of people. That's going to put a little bit of a crimp into our style.
Now, this 45 million doses, are we going to need two shots, so is that actually half that number of people?
The anticipation of all the experts is that for the younger population, the population that has never encountered a virus like this, children and young and middle-aged adults, that it is very likely that two doses separated by about 3 or 4 weeks will be required in order to give us conventional measures, levels of protection in the bloodstream. Now, that's what the clinical trials are going to determine for us, but that's the anticipation. So you can imagine that things could get fairly complicated. Here we have people being vaccinated with the regular influenza vaccine, and then two doses, perhaps received somewhere else, not at their doctor's office, we can go into that a little bit, of the H1N1 vaccine. And if that's not complicated enough for you, if we're talking about young children who are less than 9 years of age, who are receiving influenza vaccine of any kind for the first time, they'll need, you guessed it, two doses of the regular vaccine and two doses of H1N1. It's enough to make a pediatrician cry.
Yes. Makes me cry.
Not to mention the child and the parent.
All right, so if we're talking at the max 22.5 million people, this would be in the U.S., how much of the initial 45 million is being manufactured in the United States?
Wherever, I'm not sure of that number, and a couple of things. As new vaccine supplies and shipments come in, of course, we'll be able to expand the number of people vaccinated. The anticipation is that we should get about 300 million doses eventually. So what proportion is manufactured in the United States? I'm not entirely sure about that, but there are careful agreements such that vaccines that we've purchased that are manufactured abroad will actually be delivered in the United States. And I say we purchased, I mean the United States government has given hard money for this vaccine. Another new wrinkle is that at least two of the manufacturers, Sanofi Pasteur and GlaxoSmithKline, have agreed to donate some of their vaccine to the developing world. So that makes us all feel good, and that was also the product of extensive negotiations.
All right, so out of the U.S. is 45 million. Some percent of that's probably the majority that's produced overseas. So in best case scenario, we actually take delivery of the 45 million, which is 22.5 million people. And the list of who's a priority is what?
Well, there are two kinds of priority lists. One that would be invoked in this kind of a circumstance, and then there was a larger priority list, which I can't remember what the estimate was about what proportion of the population that covered, but it was very, very substantial. Now, mind you, when this first shipment of 45 million doses comes in, we're not going to give that to 22.5 million million people and then hold the second dose waiting for them to come back. The instruction will be to give that first dose to 45 million people because more vaccine will be coming along, and so those second doses then will be delivered later. I think the interest will be in getting as much of that vaccine sprayed into noses and inoculated into arms as quickly as possible in as many people as possible.
Right, that makes sense. At least they would maybe have a partial, assuming that, and of course we're hoping to get that all those second shots delivered,
sure.
And plus more. Very good. Basically, when do we think that'll be delivered? Is that still the mid-October time frame?
Yeah, it looks as though they're still saying mid-October for the initial shipments.
And then, do you know what sort of a follow-up ramp-up schedule would be for, you know, let's say December and then January, February?
Well, they're talking about 20 million doses per week after that. So that's still a fair amount of vaccine. And, you know, just between us, I have two thoughts about this. The first is I was going to say not everyone is going to come forward immediately. On the other hand, the surest way to get people interested in receiving a vaccine is to declare a shortage. Because if you do, all of a sudden that comes to everyone's attention and people do show up. But realistically speaking, I think it will take us some time to even deliver that initial shipment of 45 million doses.
Okay. Then let's get to sort of maybe the practicality of our situation we have. People who did get the swine flu already, who have already had the infection, most people it's been fairly mild. What can you say about any kind of protection they have for follow-up waves?
Yeah, let's assume one thing, that everybody who thinks they had this novel H1N1 infection already actually had it. But, of course, we know that the diagnosis has been specifically diagnosed in only a small minority of those people. But in any event, people who have had genuine H1N1 infection already should be protected this coming season, unless they're a person with immunocompromise or have some sort of blunted immune response. We would anticipate that they've already been, quote-unquote, vaccinated by the virus itself.
So even though the viruses, they do change, you would think that it wouldn't change as so much it would change the person's ability to fight it off if they've already got natural immunity.
Yeah. Sharon, that's a nice point. And so let's address it. Because the surveillance that the World Health Organization has set up around the world has actually brought in viral strains from around the world. During our summer, they're having winter down in the southern hemisphere below the equator, where they've had a lot of H1N1 activity. Some of those viruses have come in. And the CDC and other virologists have now characterized about 300 viral strains. And fortunately, this virus is very, very stable. So the kinds of changes that we see even in seasonal influenza have not been taking place so far, knock wood. So at the moment, we would anticipate that natural infection protects you and that the vaccine we're making is going to be right on target.
There have been some smattering, I guess, of cases, a handful of cases documented of antiviral resistance developing. Do you have any information about that?
Yeah, you characterize them very accurately. It's just been almost just a literal handful of cases, 5, 6, 7 cases. They've all been rather scattered, except some information that came in just this weekend of 2 cases in Seattle. But none of those cases have so far, once again I'm knocking wood furiously, none of those cases have spread. So they are incidental events And so we're all hoping that this virus continues to remain stable and treatable with the drugs that we have available, trade name Tamiflu and Relenza.
Well, then you're an infectious disease expert. Let's say we're going into the fall now. We had a lot of people ask you the question, what should parents do? We already sort of had an idea in the last week or so that the supply was not going to be the 145 million. People were saying, well, school is starting. Given that we probably won't get an inoculation or as many as we were going to get, what should we do about schools, sending our children to school?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do we lessen, our chances of getting H1N1?
So, yeah, let's talk about schools for a moment. When the virus was new and had just arrived last May, April and May in our population, we weren't entirely sure how severe it was. And we were trying to limit its spread in the United States. And then, when cases occurred in schools, schools were shut down. And the whole idea there was to try to limit transmission because the influenza virus is spread most rapidly among children who then bring it home to elders. So the concept then was close the school to limit transmission. Well, we know more about the virus now, and it's well embedded in our population. It's been smoldering in our population all summer. So closing schools in order to curtail its spread is no longer a viable strategy. That's simply not going to work. It never does work very well, but it's certainly not going to work now. So schools won't be closed in order to limit transmission. Schools will be closed, as they are from time to time anyway, if there are so many children sick and so many teachers are home with illness, that the school simply can't function. So it will be more reactive than proactive. Now, so what's a parent to do? The first thing is get themselves and their children vaccinated against seasonal influenza. So that's always a good thing to do. Number two, think very carefully. If my child or children became sick and they were going to stay home because they're being asked to stay home, we want parents to keep sick children at home, what's my child care circumstance? And if that presents difficulties, now is the time to plan for child care, not a month from now or 2 months from now when you have to do it in an emergent circumstance. Plan for that very rigorously now. Get commitments from whomever to care for your children. Another thing is to inculcate constant hand washing in yourself and your children, because that's really very, very important, and schools are helping with that. In our own community, schools are putting out Santa wipes, and they're having hand sanitizers readily available. They're putting more soap in the bathrooms. Children's schools sometimes don't have soap in the bathrooms, but they're doing that now, and so they're trying to inculcate good hand hygiene among students. Those are some of the things that schools can do, and parents.
Based on what you're sort of telling me, you don't expect the virus to sort of take a turn for the worse coming in the fall. You've mentioned the WHO has tracked some of the strains, and they seem to be stable. And the idea of not closing schools is the idea that the current strain, is widespread all through the United States anyway, and, probably throughout the world at this point. And, closing schools for the same strain as we've already got, may or may not make sense. So is the assumption pretty widely spread amongst the professionals that this strain is not going to change much going into the fall?
Well, we all crossed our fingers back in May, and they're still crossed. We now have more data because this virus has been isolated and studied as to its molecular composition by Many times over now, as I said, about 300 strains have been studied by the CDC and other investigators, and the virus is very stable. So my fingers are still crossed, but you're correct, Sharon. My expectation is that this is going to be a pretty stable H1N1 virus going forward.
Of course, we've seen a pretty severe virus in pregnant women. And what would your recommendations to pregnant women be at this time?
Yeah. Your listeners are sophisticated, but even some of them may be surprised to learn that pregnant women, when they get infected with influenza, regular influenza, have a risk of complications that approximates the risk of complications of people age 65 and older. And that comes as a shock to many people. And that's why the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, as well as the CDC's advisory committee, have said for about a decade now that all pregnant women, all women who are pregnant during the influenza season, should be vaccinated. The vaccine is safe in pregnancy. It will help prevent an illness and the complications of an illness in the mother. And there's also a study now to indicate that a vaccinated mother passes on some of that protection to her newborn infant. You know, we can't vaccinate children against influenza until they reach 6 months of age. So if a mother is vaccinated, she'll pass on some of that protection across the placenta into the baby that will help protect the baby during its first 6 months of life. So, as a friend of mine says, it's a Walmart special, two for the price of one. So there's all good reason to be vaccinated. And then pregnant women obviously should listen very carefully to the news about H1N1 vaccine. If it's available, they will go right to the head of the list. They should be vaccinated. And those are things they can do in addition to all the good hand washing, avoiding people who are coughing and sneezing. And when influenza is in your community, as I like to say, it may be time to rent a movie rather than going to the movie. In other words, avoid crowds.
Some limited social distancing.
Yeah, limited personal social distancing.
Healthcare workers. There's a recent survey in the Nursing Times out of the UK that says that nurses have said that if this H1N1 novel shot is available, vaccine is available, 30% don't really plan on taking that shot. What are your thoughts there, and what would your recommendations be?
I can't decide whether, Sharon, I'm aghast or furious. Probably a little bit of both. Those healthcare workers may not realize the reason they're being asked to be vaccinated is patient safety. We don't want them to give their infection to their patients. And the only way to be maximally sure of that is to be vaccinated. I think it is both a professional and an ethical obligation of every healthcare worker to be vaccinated with seasonal influenza vaccine and, of course, with H1N1 when it's available. And frankly, on an annual basis, we do a crummy job as healthcare professionals. Only about half of us, at best, get vaccinated. There's the occasional bright spot, the occasional institution out there that has made it such a priority that over 80% of their healthcare workers and occasionally over 90% are vaccinated. I can't state this strongly enough. There are the reasons, trivial, silly reasons, why healthcare workers don't get vaccinated. Can you believe it? The myth that you can get flu from the flu vaccine is still out there. It pains me to say this. It is more common among nurses than among physicians and other categories of healthcare workers. That's appalling. It's wrong. It's simply incorrect. Put it aside. Get over it. Get yourself vaccinated.
Along with pregnant women, the healthcare workers are at the front of the list, aren't they, for the first?
They are. They are. Pregnant women and healthcare workers are right at the top of the list.
In this survey, They said that their concerns were for the safety of the vaccine. Can you address that issue?
Surely. We make a new influenza vaccine each year. It's tested for safety and effectiveness, and we give it in the tens, if not hundreds, of millions of doses. So influenza vaccine is, if not our safest vaccine, it must be nearly the safest vaccine. The second thing is, this new vaccine, H1N1, is being made in exactly the same way. So we anticipate that it will be as safe. There is some lingering concern, because back in 1976, there was another swine flu that was created, a vaccine was made, and cases of Guillain-Barré syndrome, one in every 100,000 people vaccinated, occurred that seemed to be related to influenza vaccine. I think there's pretty much agreement about that. But since then, we have not been able in any kind of a consistent way to associate Guillain-Barré syndrome with influenza vaccine, despite intense surveillance and trying to see if there is a relation. This virus, although some people call it swine influenza, is very different molecularly than the virus back in 1976. It's true. We have absolutely no idea why that happened back in 1976, but it hasn't happened since. So I think the issue of the safety of this vaccine is, if anything, overblown, and surely the risks of illness are much greater than the risks, any potential risks, associated with being vaccinated. And in this instance, I will tell you, I'm going to remind you, I not only talk the talk, I walk the walk. I'm one of the volunteers for vaccine safety. I've already received my first inoculation with this vaccine.
Sharon, while we've got the doctor on, I'd just like to bring up a point that you and I had talked about earlier. I don't know if you're aware of the fact, but this has been devastating because of the terminology to the pork industry, swine industry, because of the name swine flu. People are literally stopping. They're not eating pork because they have a fear of getting swine flu. Can you put that to rest right quick?
Let me be going to my serious doctor mode and say there's no basis for that. there's no scientific basis for that at all. And then I'll just be a normal person and say, that's just silly. Get over it.
Get a life, you might say, huh?
Yeah, right. Exactly. My wife and I both had pork chops just recently. So we talk the talk and we eat the pork.
Eat the pork, yeah. One more quick thing before you go. Surgical masks versus N95s for healthcare workers. What are your feelings on that?
Well, more than my feelings, my thoughts. This is very much, H1N1 is transmitted exactly like seasonal influenza. And my colleagues in infection control and I are really quite convinced that surgical masks are quite sufficient unless you're doing something unusual like an aerosol-generating procedure such as bronchoscopy. Now, I will tell you, the Institute of Medicine is reviewing this. It will make recommendations within several weeks, and we will hear what they have to say. But I anticipate that that will be their conclusion also.
I think that's on their advisory. The advisory committee has already suggested that, no?
It has indeed, right. And the leadership of the Society of Hospital Epidemiologists of America, which is the infection control community, have also expressed their opinion about that, as has the Infectious Disease Society of America. So we'll see what we will see. But at Vanderbilt, we're using surgical masks, and that's been the recommendation also of the Tennessee Department of Health, consistent with the World Health Organization.
Well, Dr. Schaffner, I'd like to keep you on, but I know that you have pressing business and medicine to practice, so I would like to thank you so much for taking time to speak with us, and I hope to give you a call and get you on again.
Well, Sharon, it's been a pleasure this time, and I'd love to do it next time, and I apologize for my time being a little bit cramped today.
Well, thank you. I'll stay on, David.
Okay. And we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back right after this.
I can't hear you, David.
Concord Pharmacies have been serving the greater Atlanta area for over 25 years and has 11 locations in medical building and near hospitals to better serve you. We work closely with your physician to optimize your personal health strategy. Concord has emphasized the utmost importance of the physician-patient-pharmacist relationship. Do not assume because we are not a national chain that we are not competitive. Concord provides competitive pricing and your copay for your prescriptions is the same as at other stores. Concord Pharmacies also provide several services not found at other pharmacies. 1. We provide you with hard-to-find medications. 2. Concord prides itself in customized compounding for medications not commercially available. For more information, call 770-671-0657 or go to our website, www.concord-pharmacy.net.
This is americaswebradio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
And we're back with Sharon Sanders from Flu Trackers on the line with us. Sharon, that was fascinating.
He's great. It's just great that these people will spend time talking to us, honestly. I'm shocked every time someone says yes.
Well, I don't understand why. I think I think everybody, including myself and certainly you and everybody involved, we're dedicated to getting the word out. And whoever's, you know, the person that's listening that the doctor may have struck, he said something different from anybody else, and they're finally going to take it seriously. You know, it may be from him, it might be from you, it might be from another doctor, it might be from anybody. It doesn't matter. If we wake the audience up, and, you know, we wake up two people that start getting their kids and themselves to washing their hands more. You know, this is not a joking matter, and we've talked for years and years and years now, and I know that I've got people out there that turn us off because we've never yelled the sky is falling, but we know for a fact, you know for a fact, you and I talked about it today, that the H5N1 virus, the avian flu, has not gone away. It's out there. It's waiting. It's sort of like it's preparing its time to attack, whatever you want to call it. In the interim, we have a situation that's called the H1N1. Now, we already know how rapidly it can be transferred from person to person. It is here. It's going to happen. And as the doctor was saying, you know, you've got two balls that are about to be thrown at the same time. One's the regular seasonal flu, and the other is the H1N1. And I was a bit disturbed to hear that all of the work in the vaccinations for the H1N1 won't be available as soon as they had anticipated. So this is going, or could conceivably cause a problem. You know, I did hear him say one thing that I'm interested in and would like to ask you about as well, is the fact that, and I realize if you've had the H1N1, that's not going to keep you from getting the seasonal flu, but if you've had H1N1, is that going to in some way, or will it protect you from getting it again?
I can barely hear you, David, but what you asked was the fact that he said that if you've had the novel H1N1 illness, that you've got protection for future waves of the virus. We have a debate about that on Flu Trackers all the time. There are a whole group of people that say, you know, scientists and people that say, you know, wait a minute, this thing might change enough that you know you won't have the kind of protection that you think you have. If it's the current strain or close enough to it, you'll have a lot of protection. If it changes a lot, fundamentally changes, that's really all up in the air. So based on the same strain or a strain with not too many genetic changes, Yeah, you know, you're going to be fairly well protected. I mean, you might get a little sick, but you won't die, that kind of thing. I think that Dr. Osterholm said it best, which is basically something like, you know, he knows more and knows less now than he knew, you know, a few years ago about influenza. You know, we really are learning so much. Medical books are all being sort of rewritten now as more and more facts come out and you see what it does and doesn't do. So, you know, the doctor, of course, Dr. Schaffner is right. But, you know, none of us have a crystal ball. I don't know what this virus is going to do. I think he had a kind of a proviso in there. You know, up to now, it's been doing this. But, you know, what's it going to do in the winter? I don't know.
Yeah, and obviously it's been of some concern, obviously, that the H1N1 has continued to spread, although, you know, we're going through the months that, generally speaking, it would be less likely to spread, which are the summer months. So people are out. They're not. There's not the closeness that you have during the fall and winter and even the early spring, which that's our typical flu season. So we get a situation where people are closed up. What's it going to mean to the H1N1 and the spread? I was interested in the doctor saying that closing the schools was proactive, whereas the possibility of closing the schools this fall or even into the winter could be reactive, depending on the severity of, and I would assume, you know, the scary part when you think about it, you could have the seasonal flu running a pretty good course, which is normally, quite a number in the United States, and then you could have the H1N virus at the same time. You could have a ton of folks out of work and out of school and everything else.
Well, it's first before I comment, I want to take the time to for your favorite part of the show.
Well, let's do as we talked earlier.
I'm going to mention all the people that help us on Flu Trackers. And I know that I've been urged to just point people toward the site, but frankly, I just think that's not appropriate. All these people have spent hundreds and thousands of hours helping us, and this is why people like Dr. Schaffner, Dr. Osterholm, Dr. Fedson, and others will appear on the radio with us. It's because of the hard work of all these people. Some of them are going to be allowing me to use their real names, but many of them are you know, this is a pseudonym, just like writers of the past, and they prefer to be on the Internet in that fashion. So I'm going to read them. Alaska Denise, Alert, Amish Country, Anne, ARR309, Boogispole, Apple Blossom, Blue, Camster, Kanika, Chuck, Kartsky, Color My Quilt, Common Ground, Daisy, Dr. Rugby, Daniel Zone, Dark Horse, David Fedson, Dr. JJ, Dutchie, English Teacher, Farmer, Florida Medic, Emily, Flu Bossy, Frenchie Girl, Gaudia Ray, Jenny F., Grattan Woodson, Hogweed, German Doctor, Ghost RN, GSGS, Ganderspiel, Hawkeye, Harpsong, High Risk, Hornblower, Ida, Einarhopper, Jeremy, J. Jackson, Jimmo, Jonesy, John Barry, KBD, Kent Nickel, Kiwi Bird, Laidback Owl, Legadillo, Lily, SW, El Monte, Mama Bird, M. Beltran, Melly, MHSC, Mingus, Mixon, Mod Tech, Muscad, Nancy, Nico, Nyman, Nurse Nalt, Pam, W. 41, Possibilities, Prep Dead, Roro, R. Wilmer, Revere, Rocky, Ruth B. Me, Sally, Science Teacher, Scott McPherson, Shannon, Sharp, Shiloh, Snickle Fritz, Snowy Owl, Sophie Zoe, Superflu, St. Michael, Steve Osteen, Sunshine 123, Senegal 1, Supernova 1987, Tia, Teresa 42, Thornton, Toaster 2, Trayfish, Tropical, The Foreigner, Twal, Unpathed Haunt, Wind Waker, Vibrant 62, Wet Dirt, Wotran, WTB, Yield Dude, Zima Girl, and Zakermis. I know that's always your favorite part, but
no,
it's
actually,
really
actually it's not, because nobody understands what that's all about. Now, I totally appreciate the volunteers from around the world that help you all, but a person listening in has no clue what that's about. So,
those are the names of all our volunteers.
They are wonderful volunteers to spend their time and give to Flu Trackers. Like you said, I know they translate. They do a lot of things that they don't get, I'm sure they get no credit for, But it's unfortunate that nobody knows, you know, wouldn't have a clue who those people were other than a couple of names that went by that I happen to know. But, you know, that's a shame.
They choose to post anonymously, and that's their choice. So,
sure.
Anyway.
And I think people should go to your website, which is flutrackers.com, and look them up and maybe even Twitter them, or they could tweet them, or they could just send them an email and say thank you, or send it to Flu Trackers in general and say thank you to all of the volunteers from around the world that help you all out. I think that would be the best approach.
Anyway, so we were talking about the possibility of the virus changing. And again, I don't think anyone has a crystal ball. Nobody knows. And then that goes to the school issue. There's a big debate on the site about that, too. You know, if it stays in the same, do you close the schools? And the thing is, you know, he did say, Dr. Schaffner, that if you're a pregnant woman, you know, you need to be very careful, very, very careful. And so, you know, people need to evaluate their public schools, and you know, they act as a hub in most communities. You know, community halls are used for community meetings. The school is usually have libraries in them. There's functions there. So people need to evaluate the schools and the disease status in their area, and those local public health officials need to make decisions based on the information they've got locally. And you know, if the swine flu stays in the same status as it is now, you know, the local public health officials with the local disease situation in those areas need to make an assessment. And if, like Dr. Schaffner said, he's had his fingers crossed. You know, but if this thing changes and becomes more virulent than it is now, then, you know, I think all bets are off. And I would be guessing that you might get other interim guidances coming out of the CDC or not. I don't know. But, you know, people really need to think for themselves. They need to have more than one venue for information. They need to look at the reasonableness of this and what makes sense to them. You know, well, Flu Trackers is basically run by parents. You know, the people who are administrating Flu Trackers are not MDs. We're parents. So, you know, for myself, you know, I'm watching the disease status where I am. And, you know, I won't hesitate to, you know, not put my family in situations that I think are dangerous or semi-dangerous threatened.
One thing that I didn't hear Dr. Schaffner say is that, and I don't believe you asked the question, but the clock is ticking. Most schools, I don't know about Florida, but the schools up here are all back in session. So I would say the clock is on and ticking, and we should know something very, very shortly of how viral the H1N1 will be.
Well, you only know what's going on today. You know, there are a lot of flu viruses out there, and they mix and match their genetic material. And today, we can say something. You know, what will we be talking about next week? I don't know. Nobody saw this novel swine flu. It came out of nowhere. Nobody was following it. Nobody was following it. We found it, you know, by searching for bird flu and pneumonia in Mexico. That's how our site found it. For us. And so, you know, what's going to happen next week with the novel swine flu? I don't know. What's going to happen next week with bird flu? I don't know. So, you know, people need to keep vigilant. There are never before in history has the WHO declared two pandemic strains on their chart. We have a 6 and we have a 3. That means, you know, people need to be paying attention, and you need to be paying attention locally to what's going on in your community. And the CDC operates nationally, the HHS operates nationally, but what's really important to the average person is what's going on my street, you know, what's going on in my community. So, you know, we have experts debating on the side, keep the schools open, close the schools, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the bottom line is, you know, you have to stick up for yourself, and you have to look and see what's going on, you know, in your own community.
Well, what we're going to do right now, as a matter of fact, is take a quick break, and we'll be back with more of the infectious disease program right after a couple of messages. We'll be back after this.
If you, like most Americans, are feeling the economic pinch, you should know that you don't have to weather the storm alone. Now more than ever, having a solid financial team in place is critical for the future of your financial well-being. At HLB Gross Collins PC, we have the expertise and insight to guide clients through various ups and downs in the financial world to poise them for a brighter future. HLB Gross Collins PC has been helping clients maximize their financial success for nearly 40 years throughout many stages of our country's economic's peaks and valleys. Contact HLB Gross Collins PC today at 770-433-1711 or visit hlbgrosscollins.com to begin rebuilding your financial future.
Are you tired of taking medication to control your allergy symptoms? Do you suffer from uncontrollable asthma or eczema? Sublingual immunotherapy is a safe and effective alternative. Peachtree Ear, Nose, and Throat Center is committed to bringing the newest medical advances to their patients. With sublingual immunotherapy, you can now train your immune system to stop responding to environmental and food allergies. No more shots, no more trips to the doctor, and freedom from taking daily allergy medication. The drops are simply placed under the tongue 3 times a day. Both children and adults can be treated. It is safe and cost-effective. Call Peachtree Ear, Nose, and Throat Center today at 404-591-9100 for more information or to make an appointment. Their office is located in Atlanta at 1776 Peachtree Road Northwest in Suite 260 North Tower, 2 blocks south of Piedmont Hospital. They are open Monday through Friday, 8:30 a.m. until 4 p.m. Additional details are available at www.peachtreeentcenter.com. Mention that you heard about sublingual immunotherapy on Radio Sandy Springs and get free allergy testing.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
And you're listening to Flu Trackers. You're listening to the Infectious Disease Program. We've got Sharon Sanders on from Flu Trackers, and I want to reiterate what the doctor said a few minutes ago regarding the terminology. And this has been devastating, and I have a lot of friends in agriculture, certainly friends in the veterinary side of it, and a number of folks that listen to us and Twitter, and we do Ag Chat on Tuesday evenings. I want to just reiterate the fact that you're not going to get H1N1 virus from eating pork, period. End of statement. You're just not. I don't know that you'd get it if you kissed a pig, but I don't know how many people want to kiss pigs anyway. But you're not going to get the H1N1 flu virus from eating pork. And it's been terrible what the terminology, people have taken the terminology and used it wrong. And it's been renamed. It is the novel H1N1 flu virus. And that should be the end of it. So go out and get you a pork sandwich, I guess. Maybe a barbecue pork and some potato chips wouldn't be bad, would it?
Another thing that we were talking about when he was on was our healthcare workers, and I'm glad to see that they're still at the very top of the list for vaccinations. The H1N1 vaccine when it becomes available. And then he did also talk about the N95s versus the surgical mask issue. And it looks like the CDC is going to recommend change from N95s. To recommending the surgical masks are okay for healthcare workers that are treating people with a novel H1N1. And, you know, of course, we have a huge debate about that on the site also. Many healthcare workers already are not so thrilled about taking an additional vaccination, and many have expressed extreme displeasure at being urged to wear a surgical mask instead of an N95. They feel the N95 gives them more protection when dealing with, you know, ill people who have an infectious disease. I think a lot of this goes back to the fact that to this point, we haven't, you know, it hasn't been the Armageddon virus yet. You know, maybe some of these recommendations will, if the virus becomes or changes or becomes more virulent, we'll see some of these recommendations go back to more stringent recommendations like school closure, stronger school closure policy, and stronger N95 usage policies. You know, we have a vigorous debate on the site about that. Since Flu Trackers is run by parents and not medical doctors, we tend to always err on the side of caution, always, always. And that's that's our policy. So, you know, again, people need to assess their own personal situation. If you're a healthcare worker, we feel protect yourself as best you can, and use the strongest protection that is available to you. And of course, with school closures, again, look at the disease situation in your community and decide for yourself, what your level of participation is going to be in that environment. Some of the things that we're seeing in South America have been a little disconcerting. There's, the infection rate is pretty steep there in some of the countries. It looks like they've got a little bit of a hemorrhagic thing going on with some of the people that are dying with some of the infections in their lungs. It's a little more, this is not your typical flu. I mean, this is not seasonal flu. When you get this thing, if you're one of the people that's going to get very ill with it, it'll really take you down, take you out. So people need to be careful, and they need to try to not get this thing if it's in their community.
Well, I think that's, like you said, caution on the, or err on the side of caution, and you can minimize the effect by contributing or continually, like you said, always have said, hand washing, and that can't be too overdone. And at the same token, if you or a family member get it, as Dr. Daly said over and over and over again when he was doing the show, any kind of flu, be it H1N1, seasonal, or even avian flu, the primary thing that the person and or the family member should insist on is hydration. Stay hydrated. Keep drinking water. Keep drinking liquids to stay hydrated. And basically what you're doing, in a sense, is flushing the, not letting the fever get a total grip on you, but you're also helping flush the virus out of the system. So have plenty of water on hand, and for Florida, I guess you guys are sort of getting prepared, and this is part of the preparation of any potential problem. I guess you all are sort of getting, or looking at least at Bill, the hurricane coming from South Africa at this point.
Sure, the most Floridians have been through the drill over the years, and most Floridians, are pretty much understanding a natural disaster potential, and pretty readily can deal with that. They're used to it. But an infectious disease thing is a whole other story, just from the fear factor, just because it's scarier. Hurricane people always feel like, I can drive out of the way. If nothing else, I can just leave. If you have a pandemic, look how fast this thing hit the United States. It was already here before we knew we had it. It was over already. There was nowhere to run, no place to go. It was already all over the place. It was all over Texas and California, southern Texas and California, when we discovered it. And by then, people were already on the planes, spreading it all over the world. People need, really have to just stress that they should have more than one information source, and they need to look in their community for what's going on locally. And they need to look at, pay attention to the symptomology of what's going on. The countries are not reporting the cases anymore. I just think, frankly, because there's too many. They can't count them. Lot of the symptoms are too asymptomatic. So a lot of people have had this thing and they don't know it. We'll never get an accurate case count on this.
To your knowledge, is there any country that has escaped the H1N1?
No, not that I know of. I guess some countries don't report. I mean, some countries that have a lot of strife, they're not, they don't have a public health system per se, so they're not reporting swine flu. They may have a public health system, but it's not operational. So, we just have to assume it's everywhere. And so the numbers aren't really any good. And even the World Health Organization says that their numbers are underreported. I think they've counted 177,000 laboratory confirmed cases with 1,462 deaths. But they say it's an underestimation, which of course it is. It's not even close to the truth, because we're never going to really know. So, again, people need to, I don't want to just press this so much, is no matter what you hear or what people tell you, have more than one source of news and pay attention to what's going on in your local community. Influenza is a sneaky devil, and you just don't know really what you've got today may not be what you have tomorrow. And we only have to point to the fact that we didn't know, nobody was watching for a novel H1N1. Nobody was watching for that. Look how fast Tamiflu resistance spread throughout the world in seasonal H1N1. Within 18 months, it went to 100% resistance. And there's really no, you know, explanation of why in a country like Norway that had very low Tamiflu usage, they became 90% resistant for Tamiflu. That's drained very quickly. I mean, there are explanations why, but there isn't the documentation available that has been widely disseminated. We have ideas on our side of why that happened, and that goes back to the spreading of small bits of genetic material as opposed to large bits, and therefore you have many more opportunities for genetic code to be swapped, and therefore you could have, in a country that's a very low usage of a particular drug, you could develop a strain of flu that's very resistant to that drug because that strain of flu has come from someplace else and has developed this resistance using the smaller bits of material that have become part of its genetic code over time. So what this all tells us is that we know nothing practically, and that you have to take your medical life into your own hands, and your family's hands, and your near ones, and you have to make decisions based on what you can see that's going on in your own local community. One of the things that we're finding is that people who do have some pre-existing conditions, it's been much more dangerous for them with swine flu, and novel H1N1. Even Dr. Schaffner said that limited social distancing is a good idea for some people, certainly if you're pregnant. There's finding that if people are obese, morbidly obese, they're having a harder time. Dr. Fedson told me that obesity raises the inflammation quotient in a person's body, and so, you know, this may have something to do with overall susceptibility. In Argentina, they've had a very tough time with novel H1N1, and they also have some of the world's largest arsenic contamination in their well water.
With that,
there is some idea that high levels of arsenic in the water, do something to your immune system, and therefore, you know, you're less able to fight off novel H1N1.
Okay, Sharon, with that, we're going to have to wrap it up for the day. We appreciate it, and we appreciate Dr. Schaffner from Vanderbilt University. He was an excellent guest, and we appreciate you getting him on the air. We're going to have to wait and continue this and find out what happens between now and next Monday.
So, all right, thanks, David.
We'll talk to you later in the week.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.